Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards.
And me, Marcus Hippip. On today's program, we'll be meeting author Ross Razin, the celebrated writer behind novels such as God's Own Country and Waterline. We'll be explaining why he's now looking to teach some of his writing expertise to the next generation.
We'll also be hearing from Polish artist Wilhelm Sasnol. His new exhibition, Sleep, looks at the ambiguous nature of pop culture and what it means to be part of its narrative and how to put it all into a painting.
And we'll be discussing how to make cities come alive for locals and visitors alike with Nasima Razmyar, Deputy Mayor of Culture and Leisure in Helsinki. She'll be telling us how the city is looking to compete with other capitals in the future.
That's coming up over the next hour. Plus, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be here with next week's news today, and we'll have some music, Marcus, too. All that ahead on the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24.
And here we go again. It's Sunday, and the weekend's been relaxing so far, and it was nice once again to come and say hello to you, Tom, over here in the studios.
Listen, people say to me, oh, what's your ideal Sunday lunch? Is it a big old, you know, Sunday roast lunch with the family? I say no.
You leave Studio your family One. Behind and come
Forget
here
the family.
To spend time with me.
I want some quality time with Marcus.
Have you had breakfast, by the way? Because I know that, like, yesterday I had an English breakfast. I've been trying to stay away from those things, and then I had one. And I just realised that it's not good for my productivity. It's quite heavy. I felt like taking naps straight after.
It's the breakfast of champions. Let me paint you a picture, Marcus. My late white-haired grandfather, Peter, swore by a cooked breakfast every day, and it lasted him through his best of 90 years. 2 eggs minimum, good few rashers.
Exactly.
I'm telling you.
Okay. Talking about food, by the way, it's exciting times here at Midori House. Obviously, my colleague Josh Fennert and many other members of the editorial team have been busy with the brand new food magazine that's going to be out shortly.
The Drinking and Dining Directory, going to be on all good newsstands soon. To mark the occasion, actually, if people were listening earlier today here on Monocle 24, we had a special edition of The Big Interview this week where we reviewed some of the amazing food luminaries, culinary maestros that we've spoken to on that programme. Such fun to sort of raid the archive and get some inside tips from some of these masters.
You know, in that magazine, we also reveal this year's top 50, the Monocle Restaurant Awards. And actually, I'm going to be revealing the top 5 on the upcoming episode of The Menu. I don't want to reveal anything yet, but I just want to say that these restaurants, most of them don't serve English breakfast.
Listen, if you can put a contemporary, clever take, a bit of a new spin on the English breakfast, I'd say you deserve all the Michelin stars the guide can throw at you.
What else have you been up to this week, by the way, Tom?
Well, mainly, Marcus, I've got to be honest, I've been counting down to the Monocle Weekly, because one of the highlights every 7 days, for me at least, is to look ahead at next week's news today. Is the same true for you?
It is always the same for me. It's such a great way of getting a grip of what's happening in the next 7 days, and for that, we actually have to welcome someone who I don't think enjoys English breakfast either that much. That is Monocle's own Fernando Augusto Pacheco. There was something in the air that night. The stars were bright, Fernando. They were shining there for you and me, for liberty, Fernando.
Welcome to the studio. What's going to be making news this week, Fernando?
Let's talk about The Great Seducer. Macron's visiting Australia. We've enjoyed his visit to the US this week that has gone, but on the 1st of May, he's traveling there. He's going to meet the Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull. He's going to talk about quite a few things, including there's a $50 billion submarine program, which will be built by a French company as well. But, you know, to be honest, what I'm most curious about, will he kiss Malcolm Turnbull the way he did Trump? Because let's be honest, we might disagree with the politics, but I quite enjoyed actually the way Macron behaved when
Very
he went to the US.
Very hands-on, wasn't he? I'm not sure old Mr. Turnbull will take to it in quite the same way, but you never know.
Well, I think he'll be charmed. I think I love a quote, if I may say, there's a historian here, Anne Folder. She wrote an article for The Times. I love this quote, if you don't mind me reading. She said that Macron is an asexual Don Juan, in whose eyes seduction is not linked to sexuality, but instead to a sort of perpetual narcissistic reassurance.
Do you agree, Fernando?
I do agree, and I think it's almost impossible not to be charmed by Macron in some ways.
I have to say, I like his approach. I think he's an extremely good politician in the way he handles world leaders. It's quite a
literally
challenge.
Literally, in this case.
Exactly, to go and meet Donald Trump and, you know, create such a lovely atmosphere, that was quite an achievement.
Exactly.
And I reckon it wasn't easy for him necessarily.
What's next, Fernando?
Next, it's a band. Guys, I'm not a fan, but I'm coming here because, you know, they had the highest grossing tour of all time. So they will start their new tour on the 2nd of May in Tulsa, Oklahoma. It's U2. So they have this new tour called Experience and Innocence. And I have to say, even though I'm not a fan, you have to admire their financial skills. I mean, their tour 360 degrees, I mean, it did like almost $1 billion in the box office. I mean, to be precise, $736 million. I mean, it's...
Well, Faye, just on this point, they're pop cultural legends in the Republic of Ireland, but they did receive a lot of criticism for some constructive creative accounting with which they maybe minimised their tax on all of this huge earnings. Does that risk taking some of the lustre away? Because we know someone like Bono, you know, he does all his charity work as well. He's a bit of a philanthropist, but people don't like to feel that their cultural heroes are taking liberties, do they?
In this new tour, fans, because then something technological will happen and there'll be like a new magical electronic experience. Sorry, I didn't explain this very well, but basically they're saying, do use your mobile, put on your
take
face
selfies.
And
multimedia.
I have to say that
madness.
I have to say that I went through my U2 phase.
Did you?
I did enjoy U2 very much in the early 1990s when they released Achtung Baby and all that stuff. You know,
okay. The
music that very strongly related to what was going on in Berlin. I think that was amazing. But then, I don't know, maybe I'm alone over here, or maybe I'm just not a nice person who would appreciate good people enough. But I don't know, kind of taking that attitude of being like on a higher moral ground and telling other people how they should be living their lives, I don't know, a bit much. But are there anything else we should be paying attention to?
Yes, and I have a clip, guys, for you. Shall we play it?
What was that, Fernando?
Well, there was some whistling from the first World Whistling Convention in Japan 2 years ago, because the second one, by the way, this event will happen every 2 years, will start on the 3rd of May. And I thought it was quite a good initiative, because before that, they used to have the International Whistling Convention, which was an annual event for 44 years. But I think they didn't have the funds, so unfortunately they had to close down.
Who would have thought you couldn't get lots of finance for the World Whistling Convention?
But it's back. And I think the event is just growing.
Do we know who's going to win, or do we have like any idea which countries are better in whistling than others?
We don't know, but clearly Japan is a big contender. But in the first one, there were people from India, Australia, Korea, US, Venezuela, very international. But this year, the list is getting bigger. I think there's a Canadian guy, he might be one of the favorites to win. And basically what you have to do to win, you have to whistle to a piece of classical music. I'm not sure if they're doing contemporary music yet, but as you clearly could hear in that beautiful sound there, he was doing a piece of classical music.
Are you a good whistler?
I have to be very honest, I don't know how to whistle. So I can't even try. Honestly,
do you want to try?
I will try, but don't make fun of me.
Oh, Fernando.
It's so sorry.
That was terrible.
It's embarrassing.
What about the Finns? Are they? I can imagine they're dab hands at whistling.
Good. I'm going to whistle you a little bit of Mysterious Ways.
Not bad.
You, Tom?
Bit of old East London flavour for you there.
I feel rejected.
You know, one day...
You're not part of the gang.
You know, Fernando, one day you'll come over to mine, we'll eat some avocados and I'll teach you how to whistle.
I would love that, because that was a technique that I always missed out at school.
Do you want to try once again?
Where should I put my tongue?
I think we should get... Taxi for Fernando. Thank you very much, Faye.
Next in this edition of the Monocle Weekly, we'll be learning how to become great writers, or possible ones at least, after this.
London-based author Ross Rasin has received critical acclaim for novels such as God's Own Country and Waterline, telling stories of characters grappling with not only their own psyches, but often those finding themselves slightly at odds with the rest of society too. His last novel, A Natural, looked at the challenges of being a gay athlete within the highly macho world of competitive football.
Rasin's skill for finding the authentic voice within complex moral issues is no accident. He also teaches young writers ranging from school kids to university university students. And now he is looking to spread some of that storytelling knowledge a little further with his latest book, Read This If You Want to Be a Great Writer. He joins us now to discuss this. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, Ross. So shall we start by talking about the reasons why you wanted to release this book? Do you think the writing process still needs demystifying?
So I've written this book specifically, I suppose, because I was approached to write it. I think because I do quite a lot of tutoring and mentoring and teaching work to do with writing. So it's part of a series, the Read This series, of which there are probably half a dozen books now, which are, you know, they're genuinely really good. So the first one was Read This If You Want to Take Great Photographs. And they sent me that and I thought, oh, hello, this is really good. Because as somebody who doesn't generally take photographs, I read that and it's a very stylish book. It's very aesthetically pleasing and it's very simply laid out and enticing. It makes you want to go out with your camera. And so the idea with this was, could you do the same thing with a book about writing? So the idea is that it's not esoteric. It's not for people who are already at a certain level of craft or experience. It's for anybody, is the idea. So the idea is that it's approachable. And that is very much the ethos or the atmosphere that I try and instill in my teaching as well. Whether that's with little people, like 8-year-olds, mm-hmm. but the youngest that I teach, or whether it's with, you know, fully grown people. And so I go up to 80-year-olds and I teach the whole spectrum in between of secondary school as well, undergraduates, postgraduates, PhD students, older people, and I really like it. It's odd. It's been quite a discovery for me in the last 10 years or so that I've been doing it, that I like it, and I like it because in some ways maybe it's about demystifying the writing process, yes, but it's about encouraging people to enjoy it, I think. Mm. It's about making people aware that writing is not for people who are in some way special or different. Writing is about having an idea that you feel impassioned by and finding a way of expressing that through language on the page. And the whole idea of doing that, you know, so that you reach a particular audience and you reach a certain number of people, a certain publication, is very much not the way in which I think with my teaching. I just want people to enjoy writing and to get better at it.
Well, considering what kind of advice you are sharing now on writing, I wonder if there's something you had wished you'd known when you were writing, for example, your debut novel, God's Own Country.
I probably would have appreciated knowing how hard it was going to be, but that's okay. That's part of it. It's always difficult writing a novel, I find. But the thing that I've learned over the course of the three of them is when I'm going to find it hard. I know pretty much the stages that I'm going to find it difficult and the sort of emotional turmoil that will come with it. And having now ridden through that a few times, that puts me in quite a good position of confidence that it'll get finished and it will get finished as well as I can make it. I do think, actually, one of the things I realised writing this book was I probably would have appreciated it when I was writing that first novel because it tries to be extremely clear and technically helpful. Its overriding environment of the book is that it's something to enjoy. So to reassure people that difficulty is part of it, but fun is also part of it.
And that's interesting. I guess there's something about, to pick up on both your answers so far, the kind of fearlessness that you need in a way, even if it's not going right or if you're struggling or even if you've done one very, you know, critically well-received novel, if you struggle with the next one, that's also something not to fear. Do you think that maybe, and I wonder if the fact that you teach younger kids and older students as well, do we get some of our fearlessness about expressing ourselves trained out of us by education or just by habit? Do you sometimes see more of an ease for your youngest students to take those kind of punts and not be afraid of failure?
That's an interesting question. It manifests itself in different ways. I think that the younger you go, the more you step into a classroom and realise, gosh, there's such a culture here of exact attitude. Like, this is the correct way to write. Who's got their pen license? You've got your pen license. You're allowed to use a pen. You've not got it yet. You're only allowed to use pencils. Everything is about the technical template, I suppose, of how to write well in how English is taught from the top down, like how it's instilled into schools. And it takes a while to break through the skin of that and tell them, it's all right, people, you can make mistakes. Do you know that? You can actually make a mess of your book. That's fine. What you want to do is use your imagination, be creative. And you can only really do that through not being afraid of making mistakes. So the kind of mistakes they're afraid of making are often spag ones, so spelling, punctuation and grammar. Once you break through that skin and tell them, it's all right, you can draw in it if you want, I don't care, then suddenly they're just released. Their imaginations are wonderful and wild. The older people get, the more, in some ways, they've sort of told themselves what their imagination is and what they are capable of with their own imagination. And so the trick often with students who are older, like grown-ups, fully growns, is to remind them that they have an imagination and they can use it however they want on the page, and it will look different to the person sitting next to you, and you don't need to judge yourself against the person sitting next to you. You need to find the particular language for your idea. Go and do that and go and enjoy it. Make it you. Make it original.
Ross, just a moment ago you said that writing can be a lot of fun, but it can be really hard as well. I'm curious about those hard parts. You said you can almost expect them when you are writing. You know when it's going to get hard. What are those moments and how do you get over them?
So for me, I reckon the hardest part is the early part when I'm first drafting it. So I'm exploring the idea. And there are times when that's quite exciting because it could go anywhere and you don't know what it is. But so I suppose the blank page. And the stultifying effect of it on you. I've always found that hard, and I've always found it quite difficult to sort of allow myself the fact that I might spend an hour doing nothing, just staring at the paper, and found it difficult sometimes to step outside of it and think, well, you know, so with my second book, for example, Waterline, which is a novel about grief, essentially, and about homelessness and about disease, and doesn't sound very very approachable, does it? It's about grief. It's about, and in the writing of it, you can't avoid the fact that it is emotionally difficult writing something that is about something difficult, particularly if, as was the case with me, some of the feeling, the emotion that was poured into the book had a parallel with events that were going on in my real life. But I never for a moment sat down at the page thinking, you know, you're finding this scene difficult because it's a bit like that happened. Because you're so inside of it, you don't sometimes allow yourself to be a human. But I know that once the first draft is completed, I can move on from that, and I'll move on. I enjoy wholeheartedly the process of writing, and I know what my process is now, and that's explained at length in the book, the different kinds of ways in which you might figure out your own individual method. I know my method, and I can place, you know, some reliance upon it now in a way that back in the day when I was beginning, I didn't really know what it was.
It's interesting for what you just say there, Ross. There's an Oscar Wilde quote about his love of acting, and he says, I love acting, it's so much more real than life. Do you think there's something in that as a writer of fiction, that there is a way of, maybe it's coping or processing things that are going on in your head? Is there something real in your fiction that is sometimes easier than real life? If that's not a too self-consuming question.
It's a good self-consuming question, but it's a really tricksy one because, I don't know, I think I feel sometimes wariness of trying to unthread that answer for myself, because there are some things I think you'd prefer not to know exactly. You might want to have a sense of them because you are aware always that however made up something might be in the work, however acted it might be, it's all coming from a well of personal experience in some way. Mm. It's all related in some way to your experience of being a person, your own history, the way in which you have interacted with and seen people behave in the world through your life. Sometimes when I'm able to clearly identify the dots and join them, I feel a little bit frightened, I think. Sometimes I prefer it to be murky.
I think it's interesting that you mentioned being frightened sometimes, and that leads me into wondering about confidence. When you have an idea for a novel, how do you know that this idea is good?
That's something that comes up quite a lot in seminars and workshops and stuff, that gets asked by lots and lots of writers of different ages who have not completed something. And I think the answer is about completing something. You don't judge it, is the thing. You don't judge a work for yourself until it is finished. You try and judge your level of excitement for it. If in any way you feel drawn to it, an idea, characters, a world, that's a very good sign, and you should just write it. And then once you have refined it, crafted it, finished it, honed it, polished it, then you can judge it and decide, okay, that's good. Or maybe I've not quite done it to my satisfaction. Let's go in again and address the difficulties with it. And into that comes other people's judgment as well. That's one that's difficult to figure out in your early stages of being a writer, I think. It's very useful, on the one hand, to get the opinion of other people, especially if you're in like a workshop setting and you're with trusted voices who are reading your work, you're reading their work, and you're able to give good feedback to each other. But so that judgment, I think, is useful, but there's no use, and this doesn't matter where you are at with your writing, whether you're writing your very first page of something or whether you've published a dozen novels, worrying about and being preoccupied by the judgment of the outside world, whether that be reviewers or booksellers or prizes or whatever, is never going to lead you into writing better work. It's really difficult, obviously, because, you know, you're a person, you can't but not think about those things sometimes. But I would always encourage people to steer towards the work rather than looking outside of the work.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some tough decisions. And obviously, we've talked about the book, and as you said, it's a lovely thing to behold and to read. And
it's very pretty looking.
It's lovely. And there's one of the devices, obviously, to have almost sort of facsimile reproductions of pages of these pieces of fiction which you've chosen. And then there's highlighted sections to sort of demonstrate or help us to understand the points that you're making. Fantastic writers in there. Some pieces that are very simple, some pieces that are very challenging. I must ask about your process of editing down those writers you wanted to choose, because I would imagine these are some of your favourites or works that you've wrestled with or maybe read 50 times or whatever. How did you decide, oh yeah, you know, need to have some Charles Dickens, I will have Saul Bellow, but I won't have this? Was that in itself difficult, or actually was it quite easy that something always jumped out? Oh, the way to demonstrate this will be with Raymond Carver or whatever it might be.
It's a combination. Actually, can you pass it to me?
Sure, sure.
Look at who's in it. So there are some instances in which, if, for example, I'm doing a chapter about, I'm just looking at some of these here, characterisation, say, very quickly my mind went to Alice Munro, say, Raymond Carver, because I knew the very different things I could write about with reference to those texts. Some of them were new to me, actually, that I'd not read before, and I purposefully had the thought, well, it's quite a good opportunity, an excuse to read something by Javier Marías, for example. Some of it is to do with the international spread of it, because this is a book that is going out in different territories. It's appropriate that the spread of writers should come from different places. There's a spread over time. It's more, I wanted it to be more weighted towards contemporary, so it is. But there is also some classic texts like Dickens. Although, to be honest, the Dickens extract only came about because we couldn't get the rights for the one that I was wanting to have in there instead. But probably one of the most important things to me in the choice of that list, and sort of a no-brainer to me anyway, was that it was an equal spread of male and female authors. Just because, obviously, why would it not be? But that's a question that I think I probably ask of lots of texts of this nature, because I do find that if you look at them, whether it's creative writing books or whether it's to do with other art forms, you do sometimes look at them and think, well, there's just why is there such a preponderance of male authors? And it's an insidious subliminal thing that I think that sometimes for some writers, if they're creating a book like this, or perhaps even publishers creating a book like this, the go-to might be, even if they're not thinking about it overtly, well, who are the masters, you know, and those masters historically might be perceived as being men, falsely, but that's, you know, you entrench a position if you then create a new book like this that is predominantly male writers. So that was important as well.
Just finally, Ross, you released your third novel, A Natural, just a couple of months ago. What kind of plans do you have for what next?
You say that very well, actually. Since it was published, I've struggled with how to pronounce it. I get it on the page, but I never know quite whether to say A Natural or A Natural, because A Natural sounds a little bit...
It does, unclear. Yeah, doesn't it?
Yeah. I should have thought about that when I was titling it.
You just need to put it through a Finnish prison.
Non-native speaker, yeah.
I should record you saying it and have a little sort of... have it in my phone so that I can just play that whenever
I need
to.
We can do that after this interview.
I am writing something new, and I think what's happened with that is what happens very typically with me, is that I'm writing something utterly different from the last thing that I wrote. So A Natural is extremely... set in a world of extreme hyper-masculinity, of... a young boy who is inside this world of football that expects him to be a certain way, and because he's grown up inside it, he's always expected himself to be a certain person. And the tension of the book is that as it goes on, he realises that he doesn't fit that expectation because he's attracted to a man. So the new book that I'm writing, having moved from this extreme focus on masculinity, is a novel with... first-person narrator who is a woman. Although, that said, actually, I mean, yeah, she is a woman. There's no going back on that. She is definitely a woman. But she actually spends a lot of her time in a hyper-masculine environment of a restaurant kitchen where she works, and she's the only woman in it. And so the friction of that is part of the book again. And actually, I suppose it does return to similar tropes of how do you understand yourself within a certain world if that world is in some way in combat with who you are. But it's stylistically very different as well. And I am, I was going to say in early stages, I'm probably 40-odd thousand words in to it, which is far-ish. But I haven't... And, you know, I mentioned this because I think I probably say this in this book here about process. I haven't yet stopped to plan it, or even particularly to do a lot of research on it. I'm sort of threading those elements in now, but I'm doing them concurrently with the writing of it, rather than doing it in a block at the beginning, sort of abstractly. This is the plan. This is all my research. I've got all that, and now I can start writing. It's much better, healthier, more enjoyable to weave them all together.
It's absolutely fascinating, Ross. I could listen to you all day talking about
these
processes, and they're explained superbly well, of course, in the book, which is read this if you want to be a great writer. Ross Raisin should know. Ross, thanks for coming to talk to us.
Thank you very much.
Marcus, I think it's definitely time for a tune, and let's hope this time around no more whistling.
That's right, Tom. No whistling, hopefully. We'll be hearing about artist Wilhelm Sussnell's new exhibition, Sleep, in just a moment. But first, we are hearing from the Brisbane band Hatchie with some highly agreeable dream pop. This is Sleep. Sleep There by Hatchie. You are listening to The Monocle Weekly.
From sound to vision, then. We've more sleep now, but don't nod off. Wilhelm Sassnell's one of Poland's leading contemporary artists, working across film and painting. His prodigious work ethic has seen him celebrated in exhibitions across Europe and beyond. Frank and economic, his paintings use source material drawn from the internet, photojournalism, and his own life to cast world events in a slightly melancholy light.
Sassnell's latest exhibition, Sleep, at London's Sadie Cole's HQ Gallery, brings together a new body of work, drawing on art history, current affairs, and pop culture. Monocle's Augustine Macellari went along to meet the artist and hear a bit more about where it all comes from.
First thing I wanted to ask you, Wilhelm, is you have this recurrent sort of motif in this exhibition, which is this thread that kind of runs between the different paintings and in different ways, and also it's realised differently. And I wanted to ask, is this sort of recurrent visual trope, something that you've used before to kind of tie together a body of work?
Not really. This is the first time I used this, the motif of thread or a rope. But it's not intentional. It's rather, that just happened. I have a studio where I have a swing, and it's hang on a rope. And I thought maybe I can use it for as a motif. So I put it on the canvas sometimes. I spray it, and so the trace is, so it leaves the trace of rope. Sometimes I don't put, which is not new. I already used it a couple of times before. That I squeeze the paint directly from the tube, and so they form into the line. So that's how we can find the echoes of certain motif in a couple of paintings.
And does that kind of bring a new sense of wholeness to the work?
Not really, because before I was very close. I tried to be, keep a hand on hanging and putting the paintings together, decision what paintings to show. But now I think my job is in that, at least in on that stage, diminished, since I let curator or the galleries to decide what paintings to show. So I'm a bit distant of it. I believe that the works are consistent because they are chosen also by somebody else that are not that personally attached to them as I am. They create a consistent group because I made them.
So if we come over and look at this one, this is called Untitled Rohingya. I watched an interview with you and you spoke in it a bit about how a lot of your paintings either come from a place of love or a kind of place of anger. And I know that you find a lot of your images online or in the papers, or I suppose I wanted to ask about this one, which depicts, I assume, a kind of a facet of the recent sort of humanitarian crisis in Myanmar. And I wanted to ask if this is, I suppose, an angry painting in that sort of respect.
Not really. What struck me in this image, I found it online on a Guardian website, that was this Rohingya tribe living Myanmar, and what struck me was the blanket, probably everything they have, these two migrants, they put into this blanket and they hang it on the stick, keeping it on their arms. So I think this blanket with the motifs of flower is very strange. I can't say it's funny, but I think it's, in a way, it's perverse to use this image, to use this flower motif, which can be also read as a certain optimistic motif, optimistic for future. But anyway, it's been quite strange to see this blanket in this, that the road is muddy, you can't see it, it's not painted, at least you can see the traces of paint, thickly painted, and so on. But these guys trying to escape genocide, executions, having this blanket is something strange.
Yeah, and on the blanket, it did remind me of the kind of, you know, the image of someone in a folktale who kind of leaves their home with a stick, with a handkerchief kind of tied on the end, you know, like Dick Whittington.
I agree. This is the motif that I'm close with. I like also these fairy tales illustrations where you can see the man with a stick on his arms.
And if we take a closer look at the painting, I think it was Francis Bacon who said that he always gave up, he stopped his painting before he thought that he'd finished. Your process is very obvious. You don't make any attempt to kind of disguise the act of painting itself. You can still see kind of trace lines underneath. So I suppose I wanted to ask, from a kind of technical point of view, when you're making these paintings, how do you know when you're finished?
Well, this is just feeling. This is not a knowledge, of course, and this is... But I have to admit that it takes me longer now to decide if the painting is done. So it's not like it was before, when I thought, okay, just within one day I can execute the painting and it's done. It's never like that, even though I can paint one painting within one day, one session. I have to leave it in the studio and decide only the day after if it's finished or not. So this is just a feeling. This is not something I can put into words. But basically what's important for me, if the painting is enough loaded, if it doesn't look like a sketch or something that is just an execution of certain project. These are the paintings I don't like much. If I assume that it's gonna look like this, and there is no escape of this pattern, I'm not happy with it. I like include mistakes and certain decisions I undertake during the painting that change the primal idea. So that's what I like. When I see the mistakes and the struggle in the painting, that's what I like. Well, maybe this is very Catholic. I grew up in a Catholic country in Poland. No pain, no gain. So maybe because that's why I like to see this struggle. And that's one of the factors I can say, okay, maybe that's done.
You touch briefly then on, you know, that you make paintings quite efficiently, quite kind of quickly. Does that mean that, you know, they have, in, I suppose, terms of their production, quite a short lifespan? You know, you make it one day, you look at it the next. You're not revisiting paintings over periods of years or...
I do. And it also happens more and more often. I take sometimes paintings from before a couple of years and I repaint them, I change them a bit. Sometimes I have to revise what I've done.
And if we come over here, this one's called Yo La Tengo. I'm guessing it's named after the band?
Yes, that's right.
What role does music and sort of other media, but particularly music, play in informing, you know, how you paint? And
my interest in art comes from music. First was music and then was art when I was a teenager. Recently, I listened to a lot of music, and this is my... That's why I decided to paint the band. That was also how I started with, that I painted covers, the bands themselves, and so on. So this is back to the same approach of art.
So this is kind of a look back into your own past as well?
Yes.
Kind of slightly autobiographical?
Yes, that's right.
It's funny how it is quite porous, isn't it? When you're young, the kind of lines between music, you know, it's like a gateway drug almost. It gets you into art and into...
Yes, that's right. When I was a teenager, I rather thought that, okay, I would like to paint, like play this musician, rather that way. Than I didn't have the art heroes. Rather, I was a music fan. So they were the heroes for me.
So if we walk over here now, if we look at this, this is after Matisse, the dancers. I heard you talk about how the process of painting kind of allows you to find the logic of your choice of subject and kind of make you understand why you're painting something. You know, that before the painting's finished, it's almost quite intuitive and it's only when you're doing it.
Well, I don't know if there is a logic. That's the point. I wouldn't like to put it into logic. I wouldn't like to be predictable for myself. So rather surprise myself, giving up logic. So intuition is something that I really follow. But of course, later on, when I paint, when I work, I think I can understand why this work I wanted to do. I mean, with this one, that was maybe easier with Matisse, with the dance, because I always liked this painting very much. I didn't see the final version, which is in St. Petersburg. And I painted actually after this version, this, my interpretation of the dance. Basically, I liked Matisse very much. And I also realized that the older I am, the more can appreciate painters like Matisse or Picasso that I didn't care much before. But what I liked about this painting was also this pagan motif. This is sexuality in it, of course. And the closeness, I mean, being so in the nature is also important for me. How to transform it into art or to express importance of the nature, something primal, even primitive.
You know, you said that you already liked the painting a lot. Does the act of copying it kind of calcify that
yes.
Light?
Yeah, I think I just copied it. And I didn't, because I have rather poor image of the painting printed from the internet. I had to somehow invent the Matisse way of painting. I didn't remember how it's been painted, or how what are the brush strokes and so on. I had to invent for myself the Matisse way of painting. The size of the painting was important for me because it's 260 by 340 or 320, I don't remember exactly. But it was the biggest size I can bring to my studio. So that's why I decided. So the height of the painting is real, but it's cut. The right-hand person is missing. You can't see her because this is the biggest canvas I can bring to my studio.
Do those limitations that inform decisions like how big you're working in, how do they kind of reflect back into what you get from
it? I like these obstacles. I mean, this is also, that's probably one of the reasons why I painted it. If not this obstacle, probably I wouldn't think much about the size of it. Maybe I could do it, but in the other space. But because I have this space, I had to cope with it. So this missing person, it means something, of course. Nothing's ever complete. That's also part of the issue.
Wilhelm Sassnell there, speaking to Monocle's Augustin Macellari. And Wilhelm's exhibition, Sleep, is on until the 26th of May at London's Sadie Coles HQ Gallery.
You are listening to the Monocle Weekly.
Now, one of the fastest growing cities in the Nordic region, Helsinki, as Marcus knows only too well, is always looking for new and exciting ways to compete with its neighbours. Those changes often come through opening up new residential areas, creating useful new infrastructure projects, or simply making the city more fun for its residents.
We are joined now in the studio by someone who knows all about all of these areas and more, Helsinki's Deputy Mayor of Culture and Leisure, Nasima Razmyar. Welcome to the Monocle Week. Nasima. Helsinki is the kind of a city that Monocle has loved for a very long time. Helsinki even won the Quality of Life survey some years ago. How do you want to improve people's quality of life in Helsinki? What are you focusing on now?
Of course, it's always a challenge to be a good city, and especially to be a good city, first of all, for your citizens. And then when you're a good city for your citizens, for people who live in Helsinki, then of course we are a good city also for the tourists and for our international visitors. People in Finland, probably you are familiar with this, but we love ranking. We really love to be in different listings, and it's really important for us to be also in top 10 or top 3 or be even the best. And of course, Helsinki in Finland has been now ranked in quite many different rankings as one of the best countries in the world, one of the best cities in the world. But there's still a lot to work to be able to be actually one of the best cities.
So what do you want to change?
Well, of course, at the moment, the growth, as you mentioned, is huge. And the growth is actually coming very much among, of course, immigration, but also from our foreigner population. And the growth is actually at the moment in Helsinki about 1%. And I think for a city like Helsinki in Europe, 1% is quite a lot. So, of course, being able to be still a good city, to find and to challenge different kinds of social problems at the same time we are growing. But then on the other hand, we also want to be an attractive city, and we want to be a city where we have different perspectives when it comes to culture, when it comes to restaurants, when it comes to nightlife, when it comes to a live city life. So yes, to be a good city for your citizens, and then at the same time to be a good city also for tourists and be an attractive city.
And I guess, Nasima, one thing that helps to deliver on both those counts is to have really significant, specific projects, landmark openings, new builds that speak to all of that ambition. And of course, there are a couple of incredibly exciting projects along those lines, which maybe you can tell us a bit more about.
Sure. Well, first of all, we are opening this year. Actually, this year will be a really amazing year for Helsinki. I'm saying that we will have a couple of new diamonds in our city. One will be Amos Rex Museum, Art Museum, which will be open in August. And then our great proud, the Central Library, Audi Public Library, which will be in the very center of Helsinki, actually next to the Parliament of Finland, will be open end of the year. And it's really amazing that the Audi Library, there will be maybe one third of it, this kind of regular books and library mentality, and two-thirds will be totally different thinking, a lot of digitality, but then at the same time there will be cinema, cafeterias. So we are trying to also modernize our libraries. And in Helsinki at the moment we have 38 libraries altogether. So we love books and we love libraries, but we still think that the world is changing, the cities are changing, also the libraries must change. But then when it comes to Helsinki, I think it's really important to have a good strategy. And we just made our strategy a year ago, and there Helsinki wants to be a function city. So functionality is really important for us, and we want to be the most function city in the world. And probably you know what the functionality means, but for us, it's pretty much that transportation works, housing works, schools are near, elderly people can go to sports and have different facilities next to them. So to be most function city in the world, I don't know if it's very attractive, but I think it's very important for people and citizens.
I know, that's the reasonable side. I'm thinking about, you know, my friends in London, for example, who are planning their weekend getaways, and they quite often still go to Stockholm or they go to Copenhagen, for example. How do you think Helsinki should make itself more fun?
Well, there's a lot. I think it's really, really important to be fun and a live city. One of the reasons that people are going to also London, Stockholm, maybe Copenhagen is very much about a nightlife. And that's something that I've been discussing, that in Helsinki we have to improve our nightlife because we still think that there's only 12 hours in a day, and we do understand that there's 24 hours and we kind of miss this other 12 hours. So I think we just had actually nightmares from Amsterdam, from Berlin a few weeks ago in Helsinki, and hopefully we are able to learn something from different cities and make a life, nightlife also in Helsinki.
I wonder what that would mean in practical terms, because I know the Nordic region, there is often this idea that nightlife equals to alcohol consumption, and then at the same time there is very strict controls over how you can serve alcohol and where you can serve alcohol.
I know, this is of course a big social problem and we really have to discuss about that. But at the same time, I think the museums can be open in the night. We could have concerts during the nights. We could have a good coffee during the night. We could have cafeterias, because a lot of people are saying that why it's so difficult to have quality coffee when it comes in the night. So I think there's a lot of things that we still can do and it doesn't involve alcohol.
And would there be an actual nightmare for Helsinki? Is that something in trend? I was going to nominate Marcus Hippe. He knows a thing or two, apparently.
You could bring all your experience, you know, from London and from the world. But I think we have to improve. We have to do something. And there's different way of doing this.
Well, I was going to raise that topic, actually. You say that something should be done. And, you know, being Finnish, I was slightly upset in October when the London-based European Medicines Agency was getting ready to move to another European capital for Brexit reasons. And there was a poll, and the staff members said that about 70% of its staff would rather resign than move to Helsinki, for example. Helsinki was as attractive as Athens, Bratislava, Bucharest, Malta, and Zagreb. And at the same time, many people were saying that they wouldn't be against moving to Amsterdam, Barcelona, or Copenhagen, for example.
It was shocking. It was really shocking, and it was shocking for us, and it was very good experience. At the same time, we do realize that the number of tourists, it really has grown.
Overnight stays, a record year in 2017,
about 9% or something. It was about 9% this year. So it's growing. But at the same time, people doesn't want to live in Helsinki. So I think...
What's the problem?
Well, it's a very good question. First, we were thinking with the mayor and with my colleagues that, you know, we have to check the other cities. Are there better weather? Or why does this come from? So I don't know if this has to do something with the sun and good weather. But honestly, it's of course, maybe the image that Helsinki is having, we are a functional city, we are a good city. And that's why we don't understand why people doesn't want to come and live there. Because we have the great school system, we have the great kindergarten system, we have good transportation, you know, things works in Helsinki. But I think there's still a lot to work with the image. Because people wants to have a fun city. You know, in the end, if you want to move somewhere.
Exactly. Nasima, I want to ask something more personal from you. I remember I actually interviewed you about 7 or 8 years ago when you were chosen to be the Refugee Woman of the Year in Finland. You were born in Afghanistan and you moved to Finland in the 1990s. So how do you see multiculturalism in Finland and in Helsinki? And how do you make sure that everyone living in the city feels like they have the same equal opportunities and chances?
Well, I think if we look at the strategy, we have a lot of great sentences. We really want that Helsinki is an equal city. We are actually doing very much when it comes to schools, to housing, to neighborhoods. We are putting effort on those areas where we know that there's a lot of immigrants, for example. We have discrimination money. There's a lot of effort that we do. But then at the same time, what I do admire now when I'm in London, you don't have to explain where do you come from. And in Helsinki, in Finland, we still do need to explain where we come from. And maybe that comes with the fact that you were just saying that our people are ready to live there. And hopefully people like me with different backgrounds, we can also open the doors and bring this issue widely. And one person that I admire very much personally is, of course, Sadiq Khan, because I think he has been able to show that the city should look like its people. Mm. And at the moment in Helsinki, the number of immigrants are growing very much. But if you look at the high level, we don't really see that. And hopefully I'm able to be still an example, not only that 8 years ago when I became the Refugee Woman of the Year.
Oh, and that's interesting. And I just wonder about the sort of politics. If we look across Finland as a whole, like many other European countries, we've seen some unpleasant rhetoric over the last few years. We've seen more sort of nationalist parties who have been gaining a foothold amongst people who maybe are a bit fearful or don't understand how their country is changing. Are you reassured, though, that the general, the quality of the politics is going in the right direction? I mean, is there the next generation of political leaders to follow you and do what you've done? Are you confident that's going to happen?
Well, hopefully, and I do have a lot of belief in cities. I still think that Helsinki is very different comparing to other part of Helsinki is changing very fast. And in this sense, I think it's really important for people in Helsinki and for us who work for Helsinki is to compare ourselves to London, to Paris, to Stockholm, not to other cities which are placed in Finland. In this sense, we can learn much more.
I'm just curious. You are visiting London now, obviously. I wonder what kind of thoughts or suggestions are you going to bring back to Helsinki? What could Helsinki learn from London?
Actually being really diverse city in a real meaning.
Nesma Rasmeyer, thanks so much for coming to speak to us on the Monocle Weekly. And we do indeed heartily recommend everyone heads over to Helsinki in the near future. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly.
So, Tom, are you booking your flights already?
Absolutely, Marcus.
I'm very much into writing now, by the way. I've been very much into writing for the last 30 minutes, pretty much, ever since we got some writing lessons and tricks.
Inspirational stuff from Ross. And I think what's great is, and he stressed it in our chat that we had a little earlier, about not so much demystifying the experience of writing, but just making it approachable, making it fun. I think often teachers can lose sight of that part of the writing experience. And it's great. And you can really sense from his passion, his commitment to it, how important it is that you enjoy what you're doing. I was inspired.
If you were to write a book, what kind of a book would you write?
Well, it would have to be a work of fiction now, wouldn't it? A novel. Mm. Inspired by Ross.
I think I would be more into like writing TV drama or something. I think my TV show would be called The Station.
Okay. And who'd be the star? Harkus Mippi?
Maybe. With Ron Edwards, a slightly comic executive producer at the station.
Behave yourself, Marcus. Though, that would be very popular, I'm sure, with the public. Let's draw a line under that, and indeed under this week's edition of the programme.
Exactly. It was the edition 460 of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall, and our studio manager was Cassie Galpin. The Monocle Weekly will be back again next week, but for now, it's goodbye from me, Markus Hippi.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Goodbye.